Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Chuck Collins, who directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-edits inequality.org. And we're going to talk about his latest book, The Wealth Hoarders, and you can learn more at inequality.org and or wealthhoarders.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me just say, as we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you to do your part. Social distance, wear a mask in public, stay home, and find ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and economic devastation, and encourage everyone you know to get vaccinated. Before taking office, Joe Biden wrote in Foreign Policy, quote, "I will lead efforts internationally to bring transparency to the global financial system, go after illicit tax havens, seize stolen assets, and make it more difficult for leaders who steal from their people to hide behind anonymous front companies." Well, today's guest points out that he should start his work here at home in the U.S., which has now become the global center for money hiding and illicit wealth storage. And Delaware, the state Biden represented in the Senate for 36 years, is the go-to destination tax dodgers and criminal money launderers look toward. In the last decade, the United States has become the premier global destination for hidden wealth and kleptocratic capital, according to the Biennial Financial Secrecy Index 2020, produced by the UK-based Tax Justice Network. It's now the world's second largest tax haven, moving ahead of Switzerland. Only the Cayman Islands are a more porous secrecy jurisdiction than the U.S., which now accounts for over 21% of offshore global services. This was news to me, and it is just one of the many things revealed in Chuck Collins' new book, The Wealth Hoarders. I've been talking with Chuck about inequality since at least 2012, and though awareness of inequality has grown over the years, so sadly has inequality, so it's time to check in again. Chuck Collins directs the program in Inequality and Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he also co-edits inequality.org. His books include Robin Hood Was Right, A Guide to Giving Your Money for Social Change, 99 to 1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It, Born on Third Base, his own personal story, subtitled A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good, Wealth in Our Commonwealth, Why America Should Tax Accumulated Fortunes, which was co-authored with Bill Gates Sr., and this latest, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. Welcome again, Chuck Collins, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thanks for having me, Terrence.
Okay, and let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, April 27th. So first of all, how are you and how have you coped with the pandemic?
Personally, we're good. I have a couple kids that are out there on the front lines working in states where they're not as well protected by their political officials, but it suits me well to just stay put right now. So it's maybe it's my temperament and age, but it's just nice not go anywhere. So, but I'm very involved in looking at how these inequality trends have been supercharged by the pandemic, and very concerned about that.
Right. For those of you who don't know what about the work of inequality.org. I recommend there's a weekly report that you put out. Is it called Inequality This Week or?
Yeah. It's our weekly newsletter. Yeah.
Weekly newsletter. And it has been, I mean, I subscribe, and it has been so alarming and revealing to watch what has happened during the pandemic. Let me just say, it's not a, it's not a heavy sort of wonky newsletter. It's got the goods on what's going on with inequality and what's going on with the 1% and so on. But it's very readable, very user friendly. It's always got a few just mind blowing and sort of upsetting statistics and so on. So I highly recommend that. If this conversation rings true to you, check out inequality.org and subscribe to the weekly newsletter. As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And I know that you're the great-grandson of meatpacking giant Oscar Mayer, and that in 1986, at the age of 26, you gave away your trust fund. And I don't think we've ever really talked about that. Did you have a plan at the time about what you were going to do next or what you saw as your life's work?
Well, it was a while ago now, but I think at the time I thought I had this misconception that I was going to become sort of like regular Chuck Joe Public and get a job and go about my life and kind of walk away from this advantaged upbringing. And I really had no understanding of how much the privileges and advantage I had were pretty much hardwired into my existence. And that the money was just one aspect of it. But yeah, my idea was that I would, pursue a career outside of that, enormous head start that I got.
And so the fact that so much of your career has been devoted to inequality, to what's going on with wealth and money in the U.S. was not something you foresaw. It's like one foot went in front of the other, and here we are many, many years later.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was very attuned to inequality, and I think it in some ways planted the seed for the work that I do now. But and I did have this intimate front row seat to not only how wealth was multiplying and how the inner workings of wealthy families, including what you and I are going to talk about, the role of advisors, trusted financial advisors. But I also, because I was working doing, helping tenants buy their mobile home parks and own them as cooperatives, I was sort of getting this other front row seat into how working people were struggling with stagnant wages and the sort of first phase of inequality in the 1980s. So it really was very personal for me, the issues of inequality.
Mm-hmm. And as I've said a couple of times, you run the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. For listeners who don't know, what is the Institute for Policy Studies?
It's a sort of research and sort of policy support group that has been around since 1963. It was really founded by two former members of the Kennedy administration, who objected to the U.S. role in Vietnam and sort of the not challenging the national security state. And it became kind of a center for left progressive public scholars with a very much of an international bent. And in fact, in the early 70s, when Salvador Allende was president, his foreign minister, Orlando Letelier, worked in Washington. And when the Pinochet government came to power, Orlando Letelier came to work at the Institute for Policy Studies and ran the sort of opposition to the military government, the Pinochet military government. And he was assassinated in the streets of Washington, D.C. By a Chilean hit squad. So we're one of the progressive think tanks that maybe has the distinction of having had several of our colleagues assassinated by right-wing hit squads.
Wow.
So it's part of our history, and we've always had very much an international framework. Even though the work I do is primarily looking at the U.S. economy, I value having 30 other colleagues who are, have a more global outlook.
Yeah, and I would say again, listeners, the Institute for Policy Studies puts out a weekly newsletter as well, which will usually have five or six key articles, and then any places where its work has shown up in the press or the media And I find that a wonderful weekly education as well. That thing that I said in the intro, not about wealth hoarders, but about inequality, that my sense is that awareness of inequality, of the 1% and the 99%, of the vanishing middle class, has certainly grown over. Occupy, I believe, goes back to, I think it was 2012, wasn't it?
Yep, 2011, 2012.
Which is when the first sort of 1%, 99% conversation began. As I said, awareness has grown, but so sadly has inequality itself, that as much as people talk about it, know about it, look at it more, the momentum hasn't really shifted much. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are sort of on an extreme inequality autopilot at this point. You know, unless we figure out how to intervene in the system, these inequalities will continue to grow. And you know, part of it is you could call it the oligarchic cycle, which is the more wealth concentrates in the hands of a few, the more they use their power and wealth to kind of rig the rules to extract more wealth and power. And you see this coming out of the pandemic now. We'll probably come out with, you know, some larger, bigger mega corporations that will gobble up more market share. The billionaire class during the pandemic has seen their wealth go up, you know, $1.6 trillion, 700 billionaires have seen their wealth surge. So, you know, and it, in a way, the rules of the economy are sort of tipped that way. The return to capital versus the return to labor means that, you know, for every productive activity, more wealth and income is flowing to the very top. So yeah, I do agree, and I'm very optimistic because I do think public awareness has really grown. I think attitudes about tax policy have changed for the better. And I think we are about to see the beginning of hopefully a reversal of these extreme inequalities in the coming years.
I have done a number of interviews on inequality over the years, but even in the last just couple of years, Saez, the economist from Berkeley, Branko Milanović, et cetera, you know, it's a focus. And one thing that I want to mention is that Rebecca Henderson of the Harvard Business School and Branko Milanović both pointed to the same thing, which you did in your answer, in your previous answer, which is that when shareholder value is the only goal, the real problem, they said, the real place that it turns bad is when it turns out that one of the most effective strategies to increase profit is to overwhelm politics and government with money and write your own rules. And while they're talking about corporations, I think the same thing applies to individual and family wealth as well, that's where it really goes off the rails and makes itself and creates feedback loops and makes itself self-perpetuating.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that at a societal level, the United States is sort of libertarian. You know, we have a very high tolerance for inequality as long as people feel the rules are fair and everyone has an opportunity to also get wealthy. And I think one of the things that's happened, you know, post-economic meltdown 2009, and through the last decade, is people realize, the rules are actually more rigged to benefit the wealthy. Tax policy, trade policy, government policies generally, and that mobility has stalled out. Not everybody has the opportunity to advance. And so that, I think, has fueled a greater suspicion and concern about these levels of inequality that maybe in the past would have been more tolerated.
Yeah, I think the point they're making is that if the rules were fair, then that myth would sort of be more defensible, that myth of American mobility, that myth of, or that perception that, well, I could make it too, so I don't want to make it too hard on the rich, because my hope is someday that's me. But that as the rules, tax rules, regulations, etc., keep being overwhelmed by lobbyists and money, that becomes less and less true and more a myth.
I think that's exactly right.
So what led you to write this latest book, Wealth Hoarders? Was there a moment when you went, I know what I got to do next. I don't want to do it, but I got to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a little book called, Is Inequality in America Irreversible? It was just a little primer. And in there, I started to write about the role of this, political scientists call the wealth defense industry, meaning, it's one thing to say, well, the wealthy are getting wealthy, but there's actually a class, a professional segment of workers who are entirely devoted to helping the rich hide their money, sequester it away from taxes, and essentially create a separate set of rules. And they are agents of inequality. They are the enablers. They're the facilitators. Without them, the wealthy would not be as wealthy, and we would not be seeing these sort of enduring wealth dynasties emerge. So yeah, I guess the two revelations were, one, yeah, there's a lot of interesting new tech fortunes, and they get a lot of attention, but there's also a pretty sticky, durable dynastic wealth dynamic in the United States. There are a couple hundred families that have seen, third, fourth generation accumulations, accelerations in wealth. How is that possible? It's possible because there are these tax attorneys, wealth managers, family office staffers, accountants who basically get up every day and help the rich get richer and pass on as much wealth to the next generation as possible.
And I think the general public, myself included, pay attention to things like the tax law of 2017, which, it's a big reform act. It does lots of things. I know, that really it's a wealth and 1% deal. It's not a tax reform for the country. But you're talking about things much more obscure, much more detailed, the things that don't get the big headlines and don't call for big bills like that. Am I correct?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is realizing there's a huge amount of wealth, and we're talking about inequality. There's a huge amount of wealth, some estimate between $25 and $36 trillion, that's basically hidden. So that's not even in the ledger. That's not part of the equation that we're talking about. And I think what people don't realize is, we hear about things like the Panama Papers, which is sort of a leak, of, data, the Paradise Papers, a leak of data from Bermuda. And we think, oh, yeah, of course, there's an offshore tax system and the rich are hiding some of their money offshore. And we think, well, that's kind of a sideshow. Mm-hmm. But what I've come to learn is it's really center stage. This is fundamentally one of the ways in which inequality gets entrenched over time. And this whole hidden wealth apparatus is a huge part of the problem.
So you come from one of these families. You've been aware of this. My guess is that when you started digging, you discovered things you'd never known before. What were some of those?
Well, I think part of it was the scale, and particularly in the last 15 years. At the beginning of the book, I tell a story circa 1983 of visiting kind of a woman who in her 70s, kind of Boston Brahmin, old wealth. She invites me to her family office, and I'm like, what's a family office? And she looks at me like the Midwestern bumpkin wing of the family, here in Boston, the well-established families have these family offices. They manage the affairs and taxation and charity activities and, you know, make sure that the next generation is prepared to receive the family wealth. And I'm like, oh, well, how do people find out about this? And I'm like, well, they don't find out about it. There's really no reason to publicize these, you know, it's just behind the scenes, you know. And I was like, well, how many of them are there? And she's like, well, here in Boston, you know, maybe there's a couple hundred serving wealthy families, but, you know, some of them just go to Fidelity. They don't all have to have a family office. And I'm realizing, oh, this is the wealth defense industry where you kind of bring it in-house. You have your tax lawyer and your wealth manager, they work directly for you. And that's what the super wealthy families do. And one of the things I realized is, oh, the number of family offices went from probably about 1,000 in 1980 to over 10,000 today globally. To have a family office, you probably need to have about $250 million to start with, right, to make it worth your trouble. So we're talking about a lot of incredibly wealthy families.
And this family office, is it, does it, is there something that says, well, this is a family office, this isn't, or is it looser than that? Is it, you get what I'm saying? Is it?
Yeah, there's not necessarily a legal definition. It can be a family trust company. It can be simply a family office that then, you know, maybe, oversees the investment activity, but the investments maybe are made by a brokerage firm that they work with. But it is a family-controlled financial management company, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they were in the process of fending off Dodd-Frank, you know, regulation after the economic meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
They lobbied to make sure that they could stay unregulated and independent. So they did come up with sort of a legal definition of what a family office is. And they're basically saying, look, we're just managing our own affairs. We're not trying to manage anyone else's money. We're just managing our family money. So it's just a private activity. Leave us alone.
So in and some sense, it's none of your business.
It's none of your business, except that now these family offices, some of them are managing, you know, incredibly large pools of capital. Recently, there's a sort of a scandal about this company called Archegos, which brought down, you know, mm-hmm. Deutsche Bank, had to mark write off, you know, tens of billions in losses and all. Archegos is a family office, unregulated pool of capital controlled by one family, but it's a huge pool of capital. So that, you know, so there is a case to be made for maybe there should be a little disclosure and registration process for some of these family offices.
Now they know each other and they have coalitions and conferences, right? It's just that,
yes,
that those also are not legally defined or regulated.
That's correct. And, you know, and they're just one part of this wealth defense industry. Although you can get a certificate to become you can go to the Society for Trust and Estate Practitioners and get a 2-year certificate. So you can go work at a family office. You know, so it's even a growing international profession, you know, helping manage the assets of the super rich. It's sort of financial butler, if you will.
Yes. Yes. That's one of your chapters or subchapters, the financial butler. Let's step back a little bit. We were focusing there on family office, but step back a little bit. And that thing that I talked about in the introduction, which I took from your work, which is this emergence of the U.S. as the home of hidden wealth and the global number one or number two. How did that happen?
Yeah, and that is also something that I wasn't aware of as I delved into this. So, you know, the Panama Papers came out 5 years ago. It created tremendous pressure and embarrassment in Europe. It brought down heads of state.
Mm-hmm.
David Cameron, the president of the UK, was implicated. The president of Iceland had to resign. It rocked Europe. And a lot of those countries started to put in place greater transparency laws in banking, in tax filing, requiring shell companies to disclose who their real beneficial owners are. So Europe started to clean up its act. And even prior to that, President Obama went to the Swiss banks and said, look, I don't want U.S. taxpayers to be hiding their money in your banks. You want to trade with us? You want to be involved in U.S. economic activity? You need to disclose to us U.S. account holders. And so all of a sudden, the U.S. put pressure on Europe and Europe put pressure on itself to clean up its act. But the U.S. did not reciprocate. We didn't do anything to increase our transparency or bank disclosure. And so all of a sudden, the U.S. became very attractive if you were trying to hide money. If you're a Russian oligarch or you're a billionaire in China and you want to get your money out of China because you're worried someday they're going to come after you, or you're a dictator in some mineral-rich country in the global south and you're plundering and stealing wealth from your own people, you want to get it out of your country. Where do you take it? You bring it here to the United States because we have a pretty stable marketplace. You can create an anonymous shell company in Delaware. You can buy anonymously owned real estate in any city in the U.S. and you can park your wealth and launder it here. So that's how the United States has now become the number two secrecy jurisdiction in the world, according to Tax Justice Network.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I was reading this, I remember when, you know, the Obama administration turned on Switzerland, sort of, and turned on Swiss banks. And it was very interesting that I hadn't thought at the time, well, what about here? You know, it was like we were, again, sort of that wonderful American exceptionalism that we're looking out. We're calling those Europeans on their game. And then just didn't happen to join them in their solutions.
That's basically, we became the weak link, the laggards globally. In there, though, embedded is a piece of good news. If we, the U.S., start to get our own house in order, we have some ready allies in the European Union ready to kind of lift up standards globally. So that's good news.
Mm-hmm. There is this reporting system, right, that the OECD countries have that we didn't bother to join.
That's right. So now the OECD countries are sharing information with each other about tax disclosure. And recently, actually, Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen said, hey, look, you know, let's help create a global corporate minimum tax system. And what she's saying there is, yeah, let's have a treaty with all these other industrial countries where we create a floor for tax disclosure and tax rates. And I think both those things would go well together. So the U.S. would report, okay, you know, Nike pays this much in the United States and they pay this much in Belgium and they pay this much in Germany. All that information is shared so these corporations can't play countries off against each other in a race to the lowest tax rate, which is what they've been doing.
And I feel like I read something just recently that Ireland is resisting.
That's right. Ireland went to Google and to Apple and to all these countries that have incorporated their subsidiaries in Ireland.
It's funny. You said, by the way, you made a little slip there and you said all these countries instead of companies.
Yeah.
But in terms of wealth, not so far off.
Yes. These powerful countries, I mean, companies, have Ireland is pushing back. Ireland's saying, no, we're not going to be the weak link anymore. And so, yeah, off Google goes to the Netherlands, you know, where they can pay themselves royalties to a country that isn't going to tax their royalty income. So it's just it's a big global shell game. And that's why all these countries have to act in tandem.
Mm.
It's like back, if you think back to the 40s or 50s when some states in the United States had the minimum wage and we tried to raise labor standards and labor, you know, wages. But there was always Mississippi willing to pay less, willing to keep wages low. And so until there was a national minimum wage creating basically a floor, there was also going to be always going to be a race to the bottom. It's a similar dynamic now at the global level.
And it sounds like what Yellen was proposing sounds like a global version of Elizabeth Warren.
That's right. I mean, what she was saying was we should have a global minimum corporate income tax but what Senator Warren's saying is we should have an annual wealth tax. And there are a lot of other countries that are saying, kind of echoing, you know, Thomas Piketty's proposal to have a global wealth tax, that it isn't an income problem. It is this wealth, this concentration of assets that is where the huge inequalities are now opening up. And one remedy is a treaty among countries that we all tax wealth at a certain level and invest in our civil societies and not have one country being played off against the other.
Yeah. Obviously, there are huge income disparities. The CEO versus average worker salary, you know, has skyrocketed. That ratio has skyrocketed over the last 20, 30 years. But what you've long held, I think, that really what we should be looking at least as much is at wealth.
Yes, I didn't mean to skip over the extreme. And in fact, the CEO pay gap, which is, you know, somewhere around 320-1, meaning the average CEO versus the average worker pay gap continues to grow. Even during the pandemic, all these companies did not meet their financial objectives. They lost money, but yet their CEO, they kept moving the goalposts in terms of CEO pay conditions. The CEOs have reaped enormous rewards. One of my IPS colleagues, Sarah Anderson, has a report coming out on that. And she is a big advocate of something that Senator Sanders has also introduced, which is to tax companies that have excessive CEO pay, you know, over 100 times their average worker. No longer would you be allowed to consider that a tax-deductible business expense. It's a form of profit extraction for management. It's not a real business expense. So there's a way to sort of discourage companies from benefiting or from taking tax breaks for excessive pay.
Mm-hmm. No, I had seen that, and I hadn't thought of it exactly that way, that basically a business deducts business expenses, and what that rule says is it's a business expense up to this point. From that point on, that's not an expense to run your business.
That's right. It's no longer above that level. And, you know, another way to think about it is government contractors. You know, we're not going to do business with companies that have these extremely excessive pay disparities. We're going to discourage that. You know, we're going to give preference to companies that have lower pay ratios, because those are companies that actually are probably have higher wage floors. They're paying their lower paid workers a better wage, as well as, you know, not over rewarding management at the top.
Mm-hmm. So you're listening to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chuck Collins. He directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. And he co-edits inequality.org, which puts out a weekly newsletter I highly recommend. And we're talking about inequality at large, but also about his latest book, The Wealth Hoarders, How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. And you can learn more at inequality.org and at wealthhoarders.com. Wealth Hoarders, one word. So I'm just looking at some numbers you mentioned. Researchers estimate that 10 to 12% of the world's wealth, which of course is trillions and trillions of dollars, is now hidden through a combination of tax haven secrecy, jurisdictions, shell companies, opaque trusts, and other mechanisms. Is that hugely different? First of all, it's an enormous amount of money. If 10% of the wealth is hidden, that means that 10% was never being touched for taxes and is never helping the societies from which it is extracted. And has there been a huge growth in that number over the last few years?
Yeah, I think it's probably mostly grown in the last 15 years. Gabriel Zucman, who's a Berkeley economist who wrote an earlier book called The Hidden Wealth of Nations, the Scourge of Tax Havens, he used a more conservative methodology and came up with sort of like 8 to 10% of the world's wealth. But he would concur that the activity is accelerated over the last 15 years as more and more wealth is funneling into sort of the hands of the billionaire class, so the couple thousand billionaires globally. The rise in tax havens, the rise in tax avoidance corresponds with the rise in inequality.
And I'm going to jump around a little, but there are certain things I don't want to miss. And so one of them is why this really matters, why wealth hiding matters, what are the dangers of a hidden wealth system?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one is if the wealthy aren't paying their fair share of taxes, then the rest of us are stuck with the bill, or we're facing austerity. And as this hidden wealth has grown, many, many countries around the world are facing, growing austerity, budget austerity. There's no money for these public investments, et cetera. So that's an obvious one. This is the mechanism by which resource-rich countries in the global south have their wealth plundered. It is the system where global elites in countries around the world sort of siphon wealth away from their home countries. So it leads to poverty and inequality in countries around the world. And then I'd say the other big concern is the way in which it entrenches inequality and helps create these inherited wealth dynasties, these democracy distorting concentrations of wealth and power at the very top. So those are, this is the mechanism. These are the part of the gears of how that system creates these dizzying inequalities that we've both been talking about for decades now.
And one of, this is now I'm going to focus on the U.S. It's my impression that the IRS investigates and audits the middle class much more than it does the wealthy and the super wealthy. Can you flesh that out a bit? Like, how much is that the case? Why is it so? Has it always been so? And what's the impact and what might it take to change that?
Well, one of the contexts is that the IRS as an oversight agency has been decimated in terms of its oversight abilities. It's lost, since 2010, 18,000 full-time staff. A lot of those were the people that had the expertise and skills to follow the money, the complex transactions of the very wealthy. So now we have this absurd situation where you're according to ProPublica, you're four times more likely to be audited if you use the earned income credit than you are if you create some kind of razzle-dazzle dynasty trust and you're a multimillionaire. So part of it is the IRS is focusing on the less complicated, more easy to catch, more easy to enforce, and tend to be low and middle income class taxpayers, whereas their ability to really follow the super rich has been, and audit them, has been devastated.
Now, let me just cut in for a second. So it's interesting what you're saying is that the ones with the expertise to actually find the big money and actually make a difference have left the agency. Is that kind of it? Is part of that it became much more attractive to go work for some family office?
Yeah, well, that's part of it. It may have been you do hear about a lot of IRS officials going to work at General Electric and staffing out their tax department, but in this case, it was probably like really solid public servants who just took early retirement. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, they were just like, the IRS is not committed to enforcing the tax rules against the super rich. And, in fact, I think we maybe were we're starting to see a big change. I mean, just even the last couple of days, you know, President Biden has said, look, we're going to focus on enforcement. For every dollar we spend on enforcement, we're going to be able to raise substantial revenue. The commissioner of the IRS just testified earlier in the month that, you know, the tax gap, the gap between how much money should be raised and how much is actually raised due to non-enforcement, is $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year could be raised if we enforce the rules on the wealthy. So that's a substantial amount of revenue that pays for half of an infrastructure bill right there.
Right, right. No, so, I'm guessing that when you start proposing big infrastructure bills and big jobs bills, you have to start thinking about these sorts of things.
Well, in fact, if you propose any tax measure right now that's focused on the, you know, 30 million and up or the millionaires, you have to look at this enforcement problem, because at this point, that thanks to this wealth defense industry, high level taxation for the super rich is becoming more and more voluntary. It's the system is more porous. The estate tax is a joke. Mm-hmm. I mean, wealthy people are dodging the estate tax at the level where one Trump official said, you know, only morons pay the estate tax.
That's right. That's right.
So they have to be talking about enforcement and shutting down the hidden wealth system alongside any new proposal to raise revenue from the very rich.
And I was struck by the fact that you dated this from 2010, this decimation of the enforcement of the IRS. I was aware of the Trump administration, you know, sort of actively doing that. But it turns out what you're saying is that began to happen long before Trump was in the White House, and actually just after the crash.
Yeah, and it was Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership that really pushed for cuts, you know, around 2009, 2010, a case where the IRS was harassing politically conservative groups, apparently. And that led to the justification for cutting IRS, weakening the IRS, defanging the IRS's ability. And they've used that. The demonization of the IRS has been used to justify weakening it. But it's really weakened the ability to follow the wealthy and follow the money, not audit low-income people.
Yeah, yeah. And as I recall, actually, that scandal even turned out to be pretty much it was happening to both sides, that the IRS was looking more closely at that notion that if you are a nonprofit, you can only you have one arm that can invest efforts in political things and some that can't, and so on, and that when they finally did a real review, it turned out that they were kind of dealing with all, you know, with both sides, but it served its purpose, didn't it? You have that section which we've talked some about, which is the tools of the wealth defense industry. And the first one is trusts. I'm going to ask you sort of to briefly go through each of these, which will be new to some people and maybe not new to some others. But how are trusts used to hide and defend wealth?
Yeah, trusts as an ownership structure are really key pieces of this wealth hiding system, because what they do is they put the ownership into kind of a limbo state. So let's say, Terrence, you have $1 billion and I'm your wealth defense advisor. You know, I'm going to say, well, let's put a couple hundred million into a dynasty trust where you're the grantor, you're creating the trust, but you're not the owner anymore, so you're not going to be taxed for that wealth. And you're not the beneficiary, so the future beneficiary is not going to be taxed, and the trustee's not going to be taxed. So I've kind of created a who owns this wealth kind of limbo status, and for tax purposes, we're going to create a trust that will exist for centuries. So I'm going to put hundreds of billions of your wealth into this dynasty trust incorporated in South Dakota, because there's no it's the weak link regulation state for dynasty trusts. And you know, we're going to create an asset protection trust in the Cook Islands, which will be impermeable, where you're both the beneficiary and the grantor. We call that a selfie trust. They're all over the world. These different countries are creating new forms of trust to obfuscate who really owns the wealth. So a trust is one of the key tools in the toolbox.
If you've got assets of $1 million, it begins to make sense to have a trust, right? It begins to make sense if you want to minimize your tax obligations.
It's not just billionaires. Yeah. Although, you know, to really create a trust that will avoid a level of estate tax, you know, you need to have $13 to $25 million before you even have to worry about an estate tax.
The real,
you know, there is a legitimate purpose for a trust. You know, let's say you have a disabled family member and you want to make sure that person's going to have some money to live on, you know, after you die. And you have a trustee that will watch, you know, could be a bank that's going to watch. That's sort of the justification for creating a trust. But a trust is a very archaic, I go into this in the book and we won't go into it now, but it's a fascinating pre-common law kind of really feudal vestige of trust where, you know, they're not recorded, they're not registered, they're kind of like a contract, they exist outside the sort of other forms of legal representation. And so they're hard to, you know, police, if you will, to see what kind of real activity is going on there. And it's an area where there's enormous abuse.
Let's move to another one. And as I said, we're not going to go into the woods with all of these, but sort of the anonymously owned assets is obviously a big one. And we've talked about that. Anonymous real estate is huge. Right.
Yeah, and one other thing, you know, so with part of your $1 billion, Terrence, we're gonna put some of that into some anonymous shell companies. We're gonna probably get you a couple dozen Delaware limited liability companies just to hold your wealth and then go out and purchase assets, purchase real estate, purchase jewelry, purchase art, kind of spread your money around, but not in your own name, and maybe some of those companies will be based in Panama or some other jurisdiction. So, and probably we're going to have multiple layers of those anonymous shell companies, and some of them will have trusts and some of them will have partnerships. And so we're just going to keep adding layers to the shell game, if you will.
And what that means is that it won't link back to me.
Yeah. Not only will you have privacy, you'll have secrecy from law enforcement. And this is why law enforcement is really upset about Delaware, which is, you know, kind of the weak link, the bordello for global clandestine activity. People form these Delaware limited liability companies because they're locked up. You don't have to disclose who the real beneficial owners are. That's the lingo. So you can pretty much engage in any kind of activity with one of those shell companies.
You have a number in there. In 2014, 54% of real estate purchased in New York for more than $5 million, and in New York, there's plenty of real estate that is purchased for more than $5 million, was acquired in the name of anonymous shell companies. You wrote a piece in the Boston Globe that talked about, you know, what was happening in the Boston area. I will say that what I have watched living in Southern California is that in Los Angeles, and I'm going to go in here into another danger of all of this, foreign money is what it looked like to me, not being, you know, an expert on this, but first it was Japanese, then it was Middle Eastern, then it was Russian, then it was Chinese. Foreign money would buy high-end real estate, and I'm guessing a lot of it anonymously, and that would raise everyone's real estate costs. And Robert Frank points out that merely pursuing good schools, the hyperinflation of the top end of real estate by the super wealthy trickles down, raising housing costs at every level, leading to the disproportionate allotment of income to housing and ultimately playing a part in the housing crisis we see so much here in California, but I imagine in every city.
Yeah, this is one of the kind of troubling forces affecting cities right now. You have just plain old gentrification, you know, wealth bidding up the cost of property. But now we're seeing this really, the global capital coming in and bidding up the cost of land, bidding up the cost of housing. Some of that's in the form of shell companies, and it's hugely disrupted. So, you know, you have this problem in Los Angeles, but a lot of cities have huge vacant luxury units. Nobody's living in these properties. They are wealth storage units. They're kind of like when you drive by on the highway, it says American storage.
Right.
You can put all your extra stuff in this garage, you know. Well, this is like wealth storage for the rich. They're just parking their assets there to hold value. That's their hope and aspiration.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's and as I said, it as the ceiling rises with what I've always called almost funny money for a normal middle class person, their real estate costs will rise too. And eventually Los Angeles, I think, may have the worst case in the nation of how much of a family's income has to go to shelter before they can even begin to think about spending money on anything else.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the ways this hidden wealth problem really does matter, you know, at a time when many of our cities are having these acute affordable housing crises. And I would suspect even rural areas are seeing the cost of land bid up by concentrated wealth. I mean, the biggest landowner now in the U.S. is Bill Gates. You know, wealthy people have so much money that they need to spread it around and diversify their holdings. So they have some in the stock market and they have some in these other markets, but then they're quickly into real estate and land and housing, art and jewelry. Every other asset class is being disrupted by this concentrated wealth investor.
Mm-hmm. And the whole movement of hedge funds and those sorts of things into rental properties and so on. That's a piece of all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, cities are just getting clobbered by the transition from ownership with these huge private equity owners buying up huge swaths of rental property, short-term rental businesses, you know, the Airbnb, but the corporate-owned Airbnbs, this global capital phenomena, you know, it's like a triple whammy on urban areas. And it really does make you wonder, you know, who's buying up our cities, who, you know, the force of global capital on our cities. And actually, one of the things that we've been pushing for is luxury transfer taxes, and California has led the way on this, but other cities should be taxing high-end luxury transfer taxes, municipal disclosure of who the beneficial owners are. You know, you want to own property in Los Angeles, you want to own property in Boston, you need to tell us who you are. You need to meet the library card level of disclosure.
I like that, know? Yes.
Yeah. Who are you and where do you live?
Yeah.
Those
and,
two.
And what you're pointing out with that is that you have to do that to get a library card, but not to buy a $5 million condo.
Yeah. Yeah. The library understands, you know, we need to know your name and who you are because we're going to lend you these books and we expect you to return them. Whereas, you know, Delaware does not have such an onerous requirement. You don't have to say who you are or where you live. Well, so we think that's the minimum level of disclosure for owning assets, substantial assets in our markets.
Let me give you a couple of minutes here at the end, Chuck, to give us some of the other solutions that might help us get out of this pickle.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm very optimistic because a lot of these are moving in the right direction. So we talked about enforcement and needing to invest in enforcing the rules on the wealthy. And a second thing is, we need to just say certain kinds of transactions and trusts that have no real economic purpose should just be banned, outlawed. And actually, Senator Sanders, in his new estate tax reform bill, just shuts down a bunch of these kind of this alphabet soup of trusts and other bogus transactions that have no justification. The third is what we're talking about here, transparency. Corporations should disclose who their real owners are. And actually, at the end of last year, Congress passed the Corporate Transparency Act, requiring corporations to disclose who their real owners are to the Treasury Department. So that's a really important first step. It doesn't include trusts, doesn't include private equity and partnerships, so it could be strengthened. It's yet to be seen how those rules will be enforced, but it's a really good step in the right direction. If we did those three things, transparency, enforcement, and outlawing certain kinds of, you know, bogus entities, we could then rejoin the family of nations, you know, the European Union, mm-hmm. and start with the UK and say, let's create treaties among our countries that banks have to disclose this kind of activity, that we share information about corporate tax filings, that we have an international system of transparency, and then it starts to be game over. We're starting to shut down this hidden wealth system. And actually, I think that is very much within reach in the next couple of years.
What makes you so optimistic? Is it the Biden administration? Is it a global movement? What makes you optimistic?
It's definitely a global movement. We're the laggards. Others are leading the way. We can join that. The Biden administration, as you right at the beginning of the show, you know, you yeah. quoted Joe Biden's quote. You know, we're going to shut down these systems. It's the embarrassment of the fact that the U.S. has become the center of illicit funds. The Delaware is, the global bordello for, hidden cash. You know, some of those things are starting to sink in, as well as just the reality. We're not going to have a fair tax system if we tolerate this system. We're not going to have a healthy democratic society if we allow the system to continue the direction it's going. So I think there's a push coming from a number of places. And here's another crack in the system, Terrence. The wealth defense industry itself is cracking. There are people who've been working in that field who are talking to me anonymously, who are helping lawmakers write the next generation of rules to shut down the system, who are choosing to go work for the IRS or do some other work that other than helping the super rich hide their money. So there are cracks happening all throughout the system.
Very good. Well, I love ending any of these conversations on an optimistic note, because we certainly spend plenty of time examining the problems and how we got here. So again, the new book is The Wealth Hoarders: How Billionaires Pay Millions to Hide Trillions. And the websites are inequality.org and wealthhoarders.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 relevant, timely articles, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, temcnally, at mac.com or at me.com. Either one will work. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts are most of the major podcast sites, and you'll find years of podcasts searchable by guest at my site. Not all podcast sites are that searchable, so that's one bonus. If you go to my site, put in Chuck Collins' name, you'll get a link to all of the interviews we've done over the years. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again, and please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Chuck Collins. Keep up your good work.
Thanks, Terrence, for having the great conversation.